Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 22nd of May, 2013, and we are joined on the line once again today by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who has been a frequent guest on the Corbett Report in the past. For those few in the audience who don't know about Paul Craig Roberts or his history in academia, in journalism, in public service, in business, his credentials, his pedigree, I would suggest you go to paulcraigroberts.org, where you can find out more about himself and his work. Paul, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I just enjoyed talking to you, Jim.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you here, and it's great to have you here to discuss your new ebook, which is now available for purchase through Amazon. It's entitled The Failure of Laissez-Faire Capitalism and Economic Dissolution of the West, subtitled Towards a New Economics for a Full World. And I think there is a lot of interesting material in the title alone that we can sink our teeth into. But before we get into some of those types of issues that the book raises, why don't I just shut up for a moment, and I'll allow you to introduce the book to the audience and tell people what is this book about and what really motivated you to write it?
James, the book is about the general failure of economic theory, so that policy based on economic theory is erroneous and has led us down the path to hell. And what the book does generally is to show what some of these more extraordinary failures of economic theory are and how they are resulting in all sorts of awful outcomes. I could briefly give just a couple of examples. When economics grew up, it grew up in what ecological economists call an empty world. That is, there was an abundance of natural resources and a scarcity of capital, of man-made capital. And in such a world, external costs are not very important. But when the world becomes what ecological economists call full world, then the scarcities are all in terms of nature's capital, not in man-made capital. For example, the fish in the sea. You know, originally there was an abundance of fish, a scarcity of fishing boats. Today we have an abundance of fishing boats, far more than can be used, and a scarcity of fish. So when these ratios change, but economic theory doesn't adjust, and it's still an empty world economics, it misrepresents the situation. So that is sort of the basic thrust of the book. And the external costs are rising. Nature's capital is becoming more scarce. And the net result is that economists can no longer tell whether the increase in GDP is as great as the cost, particularly the external costs that don't measure into the price of a product. So that's sort of the general thrust. And I have many examples, and of course, jobs offshoring, which has been almost universally confused with free trade. The effect of this has been to destroy the ability of the United States economy to produce high value added, high productivity jobs. It's for more than a decade, as the official government statistics make clear, there's been no growth in goods producing jobs, manufacturing jobs, or even in tradable professional skills. Instead, the United States is dependent on a relatively few low-paid domestic service jobs, health care and social services. And by health care, I'm not speaking of brain surgeons, but of hospital orderlies, ambulatory health care services, and waitresses, bartenders, retail clerks. This is the type of employment that characterizes a third world economy, which is what the United States economy is on the path to. And when this happens, the ladders of upward mobility are dismantled. and therefore what has always protected social and political stability in the United States is taken away, and also the income basis for a consumer-driven economy. You can't have a consumer economy if people are not experiencing productivity gains in their real income. So that's in general the overview of the book.
Well, there's a lot to take in there, obviously. So why don't we break this down and let's start by fleshing out that concept that I think you do an absolutely brilliant job of putting forward in the book, and especially in the opening chapters, something that's hit me more so than probably in any other economics-related treatise I've ever read, which is how you flesh out that macroeconomic theories and models are necessarily based on certain conditions, certain assumptions that are taken axiomatically about the conditions of the markets at the time that they're created. And then often those models and theories are just basically kept intact, even though the conditions around them are changing. And that's something that you flesh out quite well in this, talking about Keynesianism, talking about Ricardo's theory of free trade, talking about some of the other ideas that have basically continued to persist in their original forms, even though the surrounding ideas have changed so much. Why don't we flesh out some of those concepts and how that really has skewed so much macroeconomic analysis of late?
Sure. Well, where would you like to start? We could start with capital theory. It's simple. It's very important. When capital theory originated, there was no income tax. And so the interest rate was the principal determinant of the cost of capital. Well, that's the way capital theory still is. I made an effort, wrote professional papers some years ago with some of my Treasury colleagues. And they were published in peer-reviewed places, but it's still not had any real impact on the profession. Well, once you have an income tax, the cost of capital is determined much more powerfully by the income tax than by the interest rate. And yet economists still go along as if they're living in a pre-income tax world. Another, of course, is a free trade. Now, I come at this in two different ways. In the book, I show that jobs offshoring is not free trade. It has nothing to do with free trade. Free trade is based in comparative advantage. But jobs offshoring is the pursuit of absolute advantage. It's the antithesis of free trade. And yet, economist after economist has been apologetic for jobs offshoring on the grounds that it's free trade and therefore it must work to everyone's advantage, because that's the assumption about free trade. Now, I also come at free trade from the standpoint that this is another theory that originated long ago when capital was immobile internationally. The assumption both of Adam Smith and of David Ricardo was that capital stays at home. And that's the way comparative advantage works. Capital stays at home, looks for its most productive use, and the resources go into that use. And this happens in all the countries so that everyone then produces what they have the comparative advantage in, and then they trade with the other countries. And this way you have a net increase in output for everyone, or income for everyone. Well, this theory is wrong in the present circumstances, because not only is capital mobile internationally, it actually can be transmitted with the speed of light electronically, faster than goods can be shipped. But also, the opportunity cost assumption in free trade, that countries have different relative price ratios in producing different products. This is the other basis for comparative advantage. Well, when Ricardo was writing, this was true, because this type of difference in opportunity costs of producing one good as opposed to another depended on things like climate, geographically specialized information. But today, all the production functions are knowledge-based. the relative price ratios are the same in every country. So there is no difference in how the production function works in China or the United States. And so there's really no longer any basis for the Ricardian theory of free trade. And finally, the latest work in trade theory by Ralph Gomery, one of the nation's greatest mathematicians, and William Baumol, who was the former president of the American Economic Association, published by MIT Press in 2000, deconstructs the Ricardian theory even when the Ricardian conditions are present, and they show that the whole thing was always mistaken. Now, this is too difficult to get into in an interview, but this book has now been out for 13 years, and the economics profession is not adjusted to it. Even Paul Samuelson, before he died, looked at it and said, yes, this is the situation. And and all the young economists jumped all over him.
Let me ask you about that, because you do point out in the book that many economists that you know are afraid to go against free trade orthodoxy because it signals the end of their careers. Why and how has this developed, that this has become so orthodox that to question it basically gets you expelled from the profession?
Just the indoctrination over the years, economic course after economic course, generation after generation. If you say anything bad about free trade, in fact, I would say that most economists who support free trade don't even know what the theory is. They couldn't explain it. They don't understand it. But they know you're supposed to be for it, because what they learned was it's mutually beneficial, and anything mutually beneficial is unassailable. And that's really the extent of most economists' knowledge of it, unless they specialized in trade as part of their PhD fields. So if you criticize free trade, it means that you are a protectionist. And this is something that has been demonized for a long, long time, at least two centuries. And to be a protectionist, then they say, oh, this means you would still have buggy whips being made. They confuse the metaphors. They get confused between technological change, which is nothing to do with free trade, and protectionism and free trade. But they just have all these shibboleths and mantras that they come up with. They don't bother to think. If they would stop and think and work through it, but they just see, oh, protectionists, we don't have to pay attention to that. And that's the end of it. And this was sort of the response to Paul Samuelson when he said the Gomery-Baumol book was a substantial contribution, and if they were right.
Absolutely. Well, as you do paint a very vivid picture of how so many economists can basically go along with these theories without even understanding them themselves, because of the prevailing orthodoxy. But and I think we can see that in any human endeavor, there's so much folly that gets in the way of people's clear thinking on a lot of different issues, even ones that they supposedly are supposed to know. But I think at its base, there has to be some sort of driving ideology behind the propagation of free trade and globalism generally. And my question would be, what is the underlying ideology here? Who does this benefit? And why and how is this being propagated?
Well, there are two that I know of, and I'll speak of them. First, though, let me say probably the real reason economists are like they are is that they have an investment in human capital. They learn this. It's the profession. And any radical challenge to it really tells them that their human capital is worthless, or that they've got to invest in new human capital. That's a huge effort. And their lecture notes are ready. Their textbooks are ready. Their career paths are established. And so they don't want to be faced with challenges. So that's really the reason why it's very difficult to get changes in information accepted, even when the information is known. Now, what are the ideologies? Well, the main one right now is globalism, because the owners of capital and the managers, that is, the CEOs of the corporations and the shareholders, have learned that their profits go up if they replace first world workers with third world workers. Because, as I said earlier, the production function works just as well with Chinese workers as with American workers. And yet the labor cost is dramatically different. So if they can drop the labor cost, the profits grow corresponding to the drop in cost. I think somewhere in the book I show that firms who move a certain amount of labor off to China, they end up saving $32,000 per hour. So if you transfer American wages into profits, then the profitability of the enterprises rise. The shareholders' rewards go up. The performance-based bonuses of management go up. And so this is a real monetary incentive. And so they created this myth or this propagandistic thing of globalism, the new global economy, the new economy, how everybody was going to benefit from globalism. You might remember we were going to have this new high-paid service economy of innovation. We were going to discover everything, and the lowly Chinese were going to get their fingernails dirty making it. And all of this sort of stuff. There were all kinds of prominent economists hooked their careers to this. And, of course, the corporations reward them. They get research grants. The departments get grants. They get speaking fees. They get put on corporate boards. And so this becomes a very much a driving force. Now, the other ideology is the libertarian. Libertarians simply, for them, in the final analysis within economics, what economic freedom means is the freedom of capital. But they're against labor unions. But you hear very little from them about concentration of business interests. Or if you actually can convince them that offshoring isn't in our interest, they will say, well, it's the freedom of capital. If you don't have freedom of capital, you have government interference. So it's sort of the hatred and distrust of government interference among the libertarians. They don't understand that private power can be just as abusive. And so they don't want any regulation, because regulation means the absence of freedom. And yet they forget all about robber barons. And, you know, what about the banksters today? They are a product of deregulation. All of the fraud, the bank's too big to fail, which has essentially destroyed the rationale for capitalism, because the rationale for capitalism is that it eliminates inefficient organizations. It eliminates the inefficient use of resources, but it doesn't. We now have the banks too big to fail. They've been on public subsidies, public bailouts now for a number of years, and are going to continue. So this is sort of a blind spot for libertarians. And the minute they hear somebody like me try to tell them a few facts, or the minute they see the title, the failure of laissez-faire capital, they go berserk. What do you mean? How does laissez-faire capitalism fail when you've got crony capitalism? And what they miss is the reason you have crony capitalism is because of the deregulation. It was the deregulation. The Glass-Steagall Act was repealed, which separated commercial and investment banking. The position limits were taken off speculators. The controls on debt leverage were removed. So when you remove all the regulation that made capitalism function, that's what gave you crony capitalism. And they can't see that. They don't go there. They won't listen long enough to see that the failure of laissez-faire capitalism is a direct result of too much economic freedom. Too much was deregulated. And so private power then becomes just as dysfunctional as an excess of government power.
Well, as a self-defined anarcho-capitalist, you'll be pleased to know that I did listen patiently to that explanation, but allow me to play the devil's advocate on some of the issues there, because I think it would be a disservice to the libertarian side of the argument to say that they don't recognize the possibility of cronyism, of private power being just as potentially abusive as governmental power. But I think that the argument would be that in the system where you have government regulation as the supposed answer to this cronyism of the private power, what develops is exactly, as we've seen in the last several years, the complete removal of the moral hazard from the situation by governmental agencies, which are basically in the back pocket of these cronies, who will bail out these institutions to the tunes of trillions of dollars and take the entire economy down with them in order to support the institutions. Whereas in a non-regulated economy, you would not have the government there to bail out these institutions to take away that moral hazard. And although certainly crime, fraud, and coercion would happen in any sort of system like that, it would not happen again and again and again as it happens in a system where you basically have the people underwriting these institutions at the point of a gun, by the way.
Yeah. But you see, you can make it a chicken or an egg question and argue both sides. But the fact is, we didn't have the kind of financial crisis and the need to bail out financial institutions that we've had since 2008 until the financial system was deregulated. You know, libertarians act as if we live in a world of growing and increasing regulation, but that's not true. For the last quarter of a century in the United States, in England, Margaret Thatcher's England, in France. I mean, that's why I got the Legion of Honor. I helped the French privatize and deregulate their economy. I was instrumental in this. I was a supporter of Thatcher. I was in the Reagan administration. Not that we deregulated anything, but we certainly did reduce the tax rates, the cost of capital. When you've had a quarter of a century of very powerful deregulation and privatization, and the result is what it is today, failure across the board. I mean, you know, real median incomes falling for the last decade or so, not just here, and everything in disarray, massive explosions in consumer and public debt, negative real interest rates, cost of bailing out banks too big to fail, then you can clearly see that this was a product of deregulation in which things that had worked for decades and were very sensible and were put in response to previous crises were stripped away in this blind belief that markets are self-regulating. They most certainly are not. In fact, it's not the market that needs regulating. It's the actors in the market. It's the people that are regulated. Economists talk about they reify markets as if they're alive, the same way gun control advocates say guns kill people. Guns, you have to regulate the people, not the guns. You have to regulate the people in the markets, not the markets. The market is a social institution, and its effectiveness depends on how well the actors in that institution are regulated. If you believe markets are, if you believe that people don't need any regulation, then why do we have laws against murder and robbery and rape and fraud? So people do need regulating, and that's what regulating does.
That's a characterization of self-regulation and what that supposedly means. Because to my mind, the idea of self-regulation is that the market, which of course is nothing other than the actors who constitute that market, can act directly to excise or to act against the offending entity. Whereas if you have government regulators as a sort of third party proxy, then you defer, you give your power to those people in Washington and trust that they're somehow going to be able to make things better. I think that's an abrogation of people's responsibility that would be better placed in the people themselves to actually make the choice of whether or not they want to support an institution.
Well, we've had 25 years of that, and we now have the result. And the result's clear. It's worse. It's obvious. Now, there are all kinds of libertarians who will try to concoct an argument. They'll say, oh, the whole financial crisis was due to the fact that in the 1970s or 1980s, the Congress passed a law that banks had to lend to poor black people. And they'll try to blame the whole mortgage-backed derivative scam on the fact that banks had to make mortgages to black people. I mean, there's endless ways that people go through avoiding or denying or staying in denial because they prefer the ideology to the facts. Now, I was able to break away from that just by sitting and thinking and looking at the facts and looking at the outcomes and looking at the basis for the arguments. You know, I was the distinguished scholar of the Cato Institute. I'm not an anti-libertarian. I'm not a pro-government guy. I was the Assistant Secretary of Treasury for Reagan.
Let's talk proscriptively then about the types of systems, institutions, and regulations that you would like to see instituted as a result of what we've seen over the past several years.
Well, you really can't have a stable financial system unless you've got something like Glass-Steagall. If you let investment banks speculate with depositors' funds, you're going to get everything that we've had. If you say we can't regulate an instrument as dark as over-the-counter derivatives because markets are self-regulating, you're going to get exactly what we've got. Situations where individual American financial institutions have derivative exposure greater than the world's gross domestic product. This is an absurdity. This is an absolute, total absurdity. To keep these massive institutions, a number of which are larger than most economies in the world, to keep them afloat, we have the Federal Reserve destroying the currency. They're printing $1,000 billion a year in order to keep real interest rates negative, in order to push up the prices of the debt-related derivatives on the bank's books so they look solvent. This is the result of deregulation. All human activities and institutions are flawed because humans are. But certainly we've never had this type of situation before. And the outcome is unclear. Look at something like jobs offshoring. Just start considering the external cost. The benefits are privatized in few hands, shareholders and executives who get performance bonuses. What are the costs? They're immense, not just the lost jobs, the lost consumer income, the lost GDP that's moved from here to China or India or wherever the location is, producing the goods that are not exported abroad, sold abroad, but are brought back here and sold. This separates Americans from the incomes associated with the production of goods and services that they consume. So it destroys the consumer market. And what else does it do? When these goods come back in, they come in as imports. So the trade deficit widens. We're the reserve currency, a unique privilege. The wider the trade deficit, the less secure we are as reserve currency. You lose the reserve currency status, you can no longer pay your bills. Certainly not in the United States, because it has offshored everything that it could have exported. and then it's turned its exports into imports. Well, these are serious policy failures. And they continued despite people like myself pointing them out over and over because they served powerful interests, powerful private interests. The shareholders, the corporation executives, Wall Street. So there has to be a balance. And you can't simply say, like my friend Lou Rockwell, oh, if we can just get rid of government, we would have utopia on earth. The government, I hate government. I hate it with a passion. It's the source of all evil. Eliminate government and this is nonsense. Now, I very much appreciate the libertarians' defense of civil liberty. This is very important, particularly as it has come under such powerful attack from the Bush, Cheney, and Obama administrations, and from the Republican Organization of Lawyers, the Federalist Society. Civil liberties are essentially being destroyed. In fact, I think they probably have been. We see it everywhere. You know, the president announces that he can assassinate American citizens without due process of law. That's strictly unconstitutional. That they can be detained indefinitely without due process of law. Strictly unconstitutional. That there's no privacy. They have access to everything we do or say or listen to. This is strictly unconstitutional. So the Constitution has lost all of its authority in the minds of the government, and there's very little protest.
How does the economic situation play into that loss of civil liberties? Do you think they're connected, and if so, what's the causal mechanism?
I don't know. There's circumstantial evidence that why do we have a Department of Homeland Security, much less a department now with its own military force, with billions of rounds of ammunition, with 3,000 tanks. Why was it called out in Boston to look for one 19-year-old kid? The whole thing looks like the authorities expect some kind of an economic breakdown in which distribution is disrupted, in which people are hungry and all the rest, and that they need some kind of a massive domestic military force to put it down, to put down the disorders. I don't know. I really don't know. But you have to, why do we have the Department of Homeland Security? Why do they have this enormous military force, these weapons? Why are all the, you see, all the domestic police forces are now part of the Homeland Security. They are militarized. I go from time to time to a gun club where they hold national matches competition with friends to shoot the old cowboy lever action Winchesters. You know, they're fun to shoot at paper targets and listen to, and the actions are fun. And just about every time that I've gone with him, there will be somewhere between 30 and 100 local police in full military garb undergoing concentrated firepower drills where there'll be 30, 40, 50 people shooting at the same target with automatic weapons. The gun club members are not allowed to fire automatic weapons, but the police who are allowed to use the ranges. Sometimes we're there, you leave because it sounds like a war. Why is all this going on? And some of these police are from tiny, all-white, upper-income jurisdictions. What do they have SWAT teams for? There's nobody there to do anything. Everywhere you look, it's going on. It's on and on. Now, I mentioned in the book the social dispossession of Americans, the political dispossession of Americans, and the economic dispossession. So some of this is mentioned there, though this topic, of course, is different from the topic of my book. We're kind of getting off off the track.
But it is addressed in the book, and it is important because I do see this as being part and parcel of a broader phenomenon that's taking place. And of course, your book is about specifically the economic dissolution, but the political and social dissolution, I think, go hand in hand with that. And as yourself, you've been in business, academia, government service for decades, and you've seen the transformation of American society. For some of the younger people in the audience, how would you describe the extent of the transformation that you've seen over the course of your own lifetime?
It's unbelievable. It's just literally unbelievable. And not just over the course of my life, but, I mean, it is unbelievable over the course of my life in every way. But just think back something as recent as Ronald Reagan. Imagine if Ronald Reagan had stood up and said that he was drawing up lists of American citizens to be assassinated without due process, or that he was asserting the power to pick them up anywhere in the world and torture them till they confessed and keep them in indefinite detention forever, no lawyers, no access of family. No, he would have been instantly impeached. Right. They wanted to impeach Bill Clinton just because he didn't want to go on national television and say, yes, he had an affair with a White House intern and embarrassed his wife and daughter. I wouldn't have wanted to either if I had done such a thing. That's even more recent than Ronald Reagan. See, the House did impeach him. I mean, the Senate didn't convict him. So he got impeached for lying to Congress about or an affair with a White House intern, you know. Look at all the lies now. They're endless. Every kind of lie, maybe even false flag operations on which all kinds of policies are based. Nothing happens. No one's held accountable. This accountability has disappeared from the executive branch. Now, why? Well, they used 9/11, the war on terror, fear, fear, fear. It's the same thing that has always happened. So in effect, now the United States is a police state. Every aspect of it is in place. How they will use it, whether they will use it just against a few or whether it will become general. Generally, power runs away, whether it's in private hands or public hands. Power it has to be checked. And that's, in one way you check power is with regulation. There has to be countervailing powers. This was the whole notion in the minds of the founding fathers. That's how they set up the government. So there would be countervailing powers. And what we've been witnessing is the destruction of countervailing powers. Look at the unions. They're gone. They're essentially powerless. And so there's no countervailing power against corporate power. The unions are wiped out. Now the state governors are using the financial crisis, their own budget crisis, to destroy public unions. So wherever you look, countervailing power in the United States is being destroyed, the Constitution itself. So without countervailing power, where is it? Well, right now, most power is in the hands of four or five major private interest groups. They determine Wall Street, the military security complex. Why do you think all these wars are going on? Because of the profits that flow into the military and security complex. Massive profits. You can see the power of Wall Street in TARP, in the Fed's policy, the ongoing destruction of the currency, and the ongoing threat to the dollar as reserve currency. This is the power of Wall Street. You have the power of the agribusiness with Monsanto, for example. You know, it has a green light, you know, something like 90-95% of all research in soil microbiology, plant pathology, all this is funded by Microsoft. So they obviously get the result they want.
Monsanto, yeah.
Yeah, Monsanto. Yeah. So you have the Environmental Protection Agency no longer protects the environment. It serves the function of mining, of energy, fracking, the fracking industry. All of these are massive sources of external cost. Most of the cost of these operations are not borne by the corporation. They are borne by nature's capital, the pollution of water resources, the pollution of air. All the dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico are due to the runoff from chemical fertilizer farming, which is agribusiness. So these are massive external costs of corporations. The cost may exceed the value of the product that the corporations make. Since they're not measured, we don't know. So how is it you can have an economics discipline, and you don't even know what the cost of production are because you assume the external cost is zero?
Well, Dr. Roberts, you've been exceptionally grateful with your time today, so I think we will stop taking up so much of your time. But perhaps before we go, you can tell people again about the book and how people can get a copy of it.
Well, this book is available as an ebook from Barnes & Noble and from Amazon.com. It will also soon be available in print from Clarity Press. There was such a demand for it in print that Clarity Press stepped forward, and it'll probably be out in 1 or 2 months. The book was first published in print in Germany and marketed in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. The next contract was from mainland China, which I find this is very interesting. My own publishers, who have kept my books in print for decades, turned a blind eye, because as it came to me, look, there's so much control of the media because it's owned by a handful of corporate interests that this book won't get reviewed in the mainstream media. They simply won't promote it, and so we won't make any money by publishing it. So there you have what it's really like today, as opposed to how it was in my youth. Dissent is being closed down. Independent information is being closed down. This is one of the reasons I think your program is important. People like you and Greg Hunter try to bring out points of view that simply do not find their way into the print or TV media. So people who want print copies, if they can read Chinese or German, they can get them out. if they want print copies in English, it'll be out soon from Clarity Press. You can watch their website when they announce it, and surely it'll show up on Amazon as a print copy.
Well, excellent. It is good to hear that it is getting out in print, because I think it is an important book. You'll be disheartened to note that you have not dissuaded me of my anarcho-capitalist tendencies. I think what you laid out is an excellent case for the abolition of the Federal Reserve and the repealing of legal tender laws, but I suppose that's a debate for another time. But I truly do recommend this book. It really is thought-provoking, and there are a lot of excellent points in there. And as I say, it does flesh out some of that macroeconomic history in a much more cogent way than I've ever seen in any other economic book. So Dr. Roberts, always an insightful and interesting interview. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, I appreciate your interest, James, and it's always a pleasure to talk to an intelligent person.